right, well, then I think most people that want to be here are here. By the way, there's a big contrast between today's style of the geology lesson and tomorrow's style, because tomorrow is going to be walking along a trail outside, and today is looking at a textbook. So, and we're going to go through the whole textbook in 1 hour, well, most of it, because it's only about 12 pages, and we'll hit the highlights. But before we get to that, I want to follow up on a question yesterday. So before we attempt to get earth science literate in less than an hour, let's do something from yesterday, which is, what makes the plates move? Why is North America moving towards Asia an inch or two a year? Why are these plates moving around? It goes to the same fundamental principle as why, when you stood in the sunshine today, you felt warm. Why does the sun make you warm? Because the sun's hotter than you are. And a basic principle of physics is heat will go from where it's hotter to where it's colder, one way or another, if it can. Now, heat can get from the sun to here in the form of sunlight or electromagnetic radiation. So it does. The area outside the sun is colder, so the heat goes out from the sun, and in that case, it does so in the form of electromagnetic radiation. There's a couple other ways that heat can move around. Well, first of all, inside the Earth, there's a lot of heat, but it can't get out in the form of light, because rocks don't pass, they don't transmit electromagnetic radiation, they don't transmit light, so that one won't work. But nonetheless, it is hotter inside the Earth. And I should mention, the main reason, there's some heat left over from when the Earth formed, all the way down in the core and in the interior of the Earth, but most of the heat that's still inside the Earth is still being generated from decay of radioactive elements that naturally occur. So if you pick up a rock, that one over there, there's a few atoms of uranium in here and other radioactive elements, but they're so low in concentration that it's not a dangerous dosage to be around rocks very much in most places. Leaving aside radon in people's basements, which is too detailed for tonight. But if you add up the whole Earth and all its rocks and all those radioactive elements, when those radioactive elements decay, that produces heat. So that's, and the Earth is the biggest planet of the four near the sun, the biggest rocky planet. So it's got the most heat and the biggest spherical shape for that heat to try to get out. So it's still got a lot of heat coming out, the Earth does. And it's not gonna get out in the form of light, because that won't work. The other two ways it could move are conduction, where atoms get heated up, which means they move around faster. Even in a solid where they can't go very far because they're locked in this structure, they vibrate faster in that little space. And then as it gets hotter and they vibrate faster, they bump into the one next door and it vibrates. That's conduction. It moves through the material. Rocks are not very good conductors. So the Earth does conduct heat to its surface, and we can measure that. It's called the geotherm, the way the temperature goes up and heat is conducting up to the surface. But there's another way, and this way is more complicated. So if you put, this is a pan on a stove, and you've got, I don't know, you got some soup in here that you're heating up, and if you watch what happens, you'll see the liquid starts moving around, and in some places it comes up. Yeah, so you're up here looking into this stuff. In some places it comes up, and then it moves to the side, and then if you watch, it actually sinks back down. And it might do this in more than one place. That's called convection, okay? What's happening is the liquid down here, the water, as it gets hotter, it gets less dense. So by force of gravity pulling harder per volume on the stuff around it, this stuff gets squeezed up to the surface. It's buoyant because it's hotter and it's less dense. So the hot stuff rises up, reaches the surface where it can release its heat, spreads out and cools off and gets denser again and sinks back down. So you might have a cycle going on here, here. So that's a heat transfer process. But it's not just atoms bumping into atoms, it's something that is able to move that's heated below and releasing heat up above, and it flows up and it moves out and it cools off and it sinks. Well, this could be plate tectonics, this convection. And this could be the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and one plate is over here, and one plate is over here, and the two plates are spreading apart. Maybe I should pick the Pacific Ocean. All right, this is the Mid-Pacific Ridge. And two big plates are spreading apart and ultimately subducting. It's not going to be perfectly the same shape and style as a pot of soup, because it's a complicated form of convection. If the soup started boiling, and I know this from having students run experiments to try and look at convection, they get all confused about the boiling. The boiling has nothing to do with the convection. The boiling is a phase change. Convection is not boiling. Boiling is the bubbles coming out. That's a different thing. I mean, it happens at the same time. It can happen at the same time. The same thing with the Earth convection. It has phase changes, like solid rocks melting and things like that. But that just complicates the picture. Basically, what it is convection. So the plates moving around are doing so in response to, it takes energy to move them. That energy is heat coming out of the Earth, getting released from the Earth. That's what drives plate tectonics. The best way to, instead of boiling a pot of soup, and look, I mean, it's worth doing, looking at how it moves the next time you do that. But an even better model for it is to go to a lava pit crater in Hawaii and watch some live lava come up and spread out and turn solid on top, but then sink on the edges and pull itself apart in the middle along these fracture zones. It's like a scale model of plate tectonics, but you know, Cheryl and I were lucky enough to have done that once. But we were there with some scientists who let us in, and I don't think that pond is active anymore. No, all right, but that's plate tectonics. And now we're gonna switch to the other topic for the rest of our time, which is a whole bunch of topics. I was with a group that I was one of the, at one stage of this process where this national science and other funding sources that supported this project in the last 2 years. At one stage, they brought a bunch of geologists and teachers and other people, engineers and policy wonks, but mostly geologists and teachers, to write a version of what it takes for people to be earth science literate, what the basic ideas are. Since I was one of a team of 36 people at one stage of 10 stages of this process, I don't think you'll find my name in here anywhere. And it's been edited and changed since then to this document. It's available online. It's a PDF. You can download it. But what is the point of earth science literacy? There's several points. One of them is that if you're interested in the earth geologically or in terms of natural history and so on, then you're already largely, or at least potentially, quite earth science literate, because earth science is an inquiry, right? It's not just a bunch of facts, it's an ongoing inquiry where the questions haven't all been answered, the ones that seem to have been answered might have new data that changes the way we look at those things. So it's an ongoing inquiry, and that's really the first part of earth science literacy. And then there's other things about why many adults, if not every adult, should be, or we hope would be, to earth science literate as much as possible. It comes up, I mean, we live on the earth, we get resources from the earth, we think about the earth and its history, going beyond human history, and those topics do come up. They come up in your school district, they come up from your president, they come up from your taxes and where government money is spent, or where you spend your money and your utility bill. So if we're going to be citizens that vote and that influence policy and that are aware of where the money we put out for other people to spend is used for, and why Fred can't build a house over there by that river, but he could build a house over there, earth science literacy is important for those reasons, among others. So we'll go through it. Basic principles, the nine big ideas. When we went into this, they wanted us to have six or seven or eight ideas, but we ended up with nine, quote, big ideas. I already went through what is earth science literacy. Another argument you can make is that it seems like perhaps partly because of the size of that the human population on Earth has reached, it seems like Earth science is especially important in this century that we're now in, for the next 100 years and on into the future, because of things like the issues of climate change and other resources, water scarcity, and more people living on the Earth. To have a sustainable future, Earth science is going to have to be part of that if it's going to be sustained well for this many people. Earth science literacy. I should also mention Earth science is based on the scientific process, which isn't ever a single process. I mean, there's not one method, but it does have some principles, like the observations and the evidence and the experiments should be repeatable and verifiable. It's not going to allow for supernatural effects within the science, as we talked about on Monday, those over here. It's going to try and explain it in terms of natural world cause and effect type explanations. And there is a lot of creativity in science as well, by the way. It's not just logic and cold objectivity. And it gets published in peer review. It's not just an idea you made up right now. It's going to revolutionize science. You better back it up, have the evidence, have the logic, publish the paper after review, and then see what other people make of it. Then it might become science. But we can all take part in those initial stages and sometimes make discoveries that do become part of the scientific record. So big idea number one is emphasizing how Earth science is a science, okay? I also teach astronomy sometimes, and just because the words sound similar, a student will ask me about astrology. Well, the big difference is astrology is not a science and astronomy is. Earth science, it's a science. It's not, it's not crystal healing or whatever. And not only that, it's a basic science. As if you look at the education standards for this country, whether it's from the National Science Foundation, the National Education Council, what's the board that Congress supports? Anyway, the federal level, nationwide outfits that decide what should be taught, if possible, in schools around the country, public school districts around the country. It's physics, chemistry, biology, and earth science. It includes earth science at every level, through high school. It's one of the basic sciences. It's not just the sum of physics, chemistry, and biology applied to the earth. It's also its own science, with some of its own principles and ways of thinking about things. Now, earth scientists find solutions to society's needs. Some universities are mostly research-oriented, just to answer questions about things. Others are more oriented towards training people to be miners and oil discoverers, ore deposit discoverers and oil discoverers and water resource providers and environmental cleanup experts. Those can also be trained as geologists. And those are solutions to society's needs. It's not just for answering theoretical questions that geology has done. The origin of geology as a science in Europe really comes mainly out of mining, from people that were doing mining and other engineering that was digging into the earth. And then since then, they discovered the uses for oil, fossil fuel, and there's still a lot of geologists who are working for oil companies as well as mining companies, along with the ones doing other forms of research. To be a geologist, if you were to study geology, then you would find that you had to take a lot of physics, or a fair amount anyway, and chemistry, and some biology, especially, and paleontology, which is biology of the past, is recorded in the rocks and fossils. It's a very interdisciplinary science. There's a lot of ways you can go in earth science. By the way, if I say geology, I mean earth science. If I say earth science, I have a big vision of what the word geology means, okay? And this group that put together Earth Science Literacy did a separate one for ocean science literacy. So I guess geology doesn't quite include oceanography exactly. But there's some overlap there.
people who take, like, I was thinking about, what was that movie done by the former vice president, Al Gore?
Oh, An Inconvenient Truth.
Inconvenient Truth. They were taking ice core samples?
Yeah.
Does that fall in the realm?
Those are, yeah, glaciologists, climatologists, or quaternary scientists who studied just the last couple million years of Earth history. They all, most of them came through geology departments or earth science departments where they were right next door to a bunch of geologists. A few of them are atmospheric scientists who got into glaciers and that sort of thing. So that might have been one building over from the geology department. But people studying glaciers are generally considered a specialized form of geologist.
Oh.
At least geologists think of them that way. You have to ask one of them if they think of themselves that way.
Because they were taking, the samples that they were coming out with was speaking more to the degree of carbon.
Yeah. Well, I know a guy named Eric Steig who was a student with me at the University of Washington, and he's now a glacial and gas, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere expert who's been, he's been looking at cores of ice from Antarctica and so on. And he's a geologist, but now he's a climatologist as well. So not everyone went that path. Some came from atmospheric science into glaciology. But there's a strong overlap.
What other disciplines would be included in earth science? Strikes me that, for instance, soil scientists would.
So, yeah. I mean, and these, you could do a diagram of and show that they overlap, but they're not completely included in earth science. Like soil science also goes into agricultural science. And glaciology also goes into atmospheric science, where it's partly outside of geology. But there's a big overlap. Soil science. I mean, we could make a long list if we worked on it for a while. But let me think. What that does is it allows people who go into science or who are curious and find themselves being scientists, whether they thought of it that way or not. There's a lot of leeway to be creative and combine different disciplines. And it might disturb certain old professors or deans at schools that don't, if you're studying geology, you got to be here taking these classes, not over there taking those classes. But creative people can find ways to span to bridge those disciplines. And a lot of that happens in earth science, and where you get biologists coming in or going out because they're studying paleontology and things like that. There's a guy at university, my examples mostly come from University of Washington as far as university level goes. From when I was a student there mostly. There's a professor there who has tried to shift over to the biology department, but that may be more for political reasons because he didn't feel supported strongly enough. He's a paleontologist by the geology department. I better move on to some more points here. Earth scientists use their understanding of the past to forecast the Earth's future. I mean, a point I want to be getting across from this big idea here is that it's not just rocks, even though you can get a lot of information out of rocks in the Earth. It's also glaciers, it's also et cetera, et cetera. For instance, a lot of geologists are now climate scientists because the Earth's history records what Earth's climate has done in the past. I mean, the rocks and the glaciers and so on record what the climate has done in the past. And so if we can't understand what was causing climate change in the past, we probably can't it weakens our chances of forecasting, well, understanding what's happening now and forecasting what's going to happen in the future. So we can't put the Earth in a laboratory completely, but we can use it as a complete record of how climate change can work in the past and see if we can explain it and figure it out and even get the models, the computerized models, to mimic it well enough to have some confidence in the computer models. So the past, understanding the past is useful for forecasting the future as well. Okay, again, Earth, yeah, take one. That's our textbook. If anyone else want a copy, there's a couple more left. So, big idea number two, besides how Earth science is a science that interacts and overlaps with a bunch of other sciences, et cetera. Big idea number two is that the Earth is old and that Earth science partly reconstructs Earth history in various ways and makes use of that information. I was in the minority. I was pushing for the I thought we should list the Earth as being 4.5 billion years old because the solar system started forming a little bit after 4.6 billion years ago, and the Earth did not definitively, as far as we can tell, differentiate at least a core mantle crust until slightly closer to 4.5 billion years ago. So if you round it off, it seems to me that makes the Earth 4.5 billion years, but I guess by 4.55 billion years ago, the Earth was at least largely formed. So that's, we're going to round it up and call it 4.6 billion years. And that can be measured pretty precisely, well, but in various ways. But there's no rock on Earth, I should mention, if we're talking about the age of the Earth, that's been measured as 4.6 or even 4.5 or even 4.4 or even 4.3 billion years old. The oldest rock on Earth is not quite, you know, and by the way, the way to measure as precisely as possible the age of a rock, certain types of rock, like granite, when they form by solidifying from a magma, they have radioactive isotopes in the minerals that decay and turn into a different type of element, like uranium turns into lead. And so there's a mineral that will take in uranium, but lead doesn't fit into its structure. So later you can check it and see how much uranium is in it and how much lead is in there. And by knowing how long it takes uranium to turn into lead, you can get the age of the rock. And it's a tricky process because you want to make sure your system hasn't leaked, and maybe lead did somehow leak in from somewhere else or whatever, or some of the uranium escaped before you measure how much was there. So you got to be careful about it. But if you do it right, and then you can also use several methods and see if you're getting consistent results from different isotopes, different clocks.
Plus, and carbon dating different from what you...
Carbon dating is pretty much just the same because carbon-14 is a radioactive form of carbon. It's a little bit unique in that it has a for geological purposes, it has a short half-life. It's a pretty fast clock. It's got what they call a half-life of 5,730 years. So there's no carbon-14 left over from more than, you know, 100,000 years ago or so.
Yeah.
And the reason there is any carbon-14 is because cosmic radiation turns nitrogen in the atmosphere. Occasionally, a high-energy ray, bam, hits the nucleus of a nitrogen and turns it into a carbon-14. And that creates a background amount. And then the question is, has it always been the same background amount? Because that's where we'd start our clock. If we measure, let's say you're a tree, and 30,000 years ago, somebody cuts you down to make a fire while they're painting a cave. And then that person dies, but they leave the ashes of the fire behind. And then you find this really beautiful cave in France or Spain. And you want to find out how long ago these people were here, and you find this log they burned. Look, the humans built this fire, we can tell. So you radio, when that tree died, it stopped taking in carbon-14 from the atmosphere, so it started whatever was in there. And by the way, it's just a minority of the carbon in the world is carbon-14, a small, less than 1%, a fraction of 1% of the carbon, like in this wood or in us, is carbon-14. Most of it's carbon-12. But that little bit of carbon-14 can be measured for up to 40, 50, 60,000 years before it's decayed away so much there's not enough left to measure. So if it was a 30,000-year-old fire log, they could figure out that there's people in there building a fire and maybe at the same time making the cave paintings 30,000 years ago.
But if it's like 100,000 years ago, they wouldn't know.
They would just find zero carbon-14 and know that it's more than 60 or 70,000 years old. So like dinosaurs, they don't find the carbon-14 in there. Even, of course, a lot of fossils are no longer the original material either. Like dinosaur bones may have some of the original skeletal material in them, or it may have been completely replaced after it was buried in the earth by other minerals precipitating out and undergoing chemical reactions with the initial skeleton. So fossils may or may not be some of the original remains. They may have been totally mineralized into a new mineral that mimics the original stuff. But in, you know, on the other hand, they have found little bits of dinosaur tissue and bones not completely replaced by minerals, but people are still hoping for that Jurassic Park breakthrough.
So you're telling us how old rocks were?
What's that?
How old are rocks?
What do you mean?
Well, you were asking us how, you were going to tell us how old the oldest rock was.
Oh, the oldest rock. Oh yeah. It just, last I checked, 3.96, we rounded up to 4 billion years old. Okay? The reason Earth doesn't have rocks, a lot of old rocks from when the Earth first formed, assuming it really did form around 4.6 billion years ago, it's because the Earth is so geologically active, it keeps recycling its plates back down to the mantle and remelting them or absorbing them. And it erodes things and it covers things up with younger rocks and volcanoes and sediments. So you got to look around pretty hard to find remnants of the early Earth in certain parts of some of the continents. And even then, it only goes back, and this is up in Canada where they find those 4 billion-year-old rocks. They have found minerals in preserved sandstone that formed from eroded minerals from elsewhere that got together as a sediment and then turned into rock. Some of those individual minerals go back to 4.3 billion years on Earth, down in Australia, I think it is. But the reason we think the Earth is 4.6 billion years old is from studying other materials in the solar system, moon rocks and meteorites that apparently come from the asteroid belt. As an independent check, astronomers can calculate how old the sun is. A star is a lot simpler than a planet like the Earth. A star is a bunch of hydrogen and helium undergoing what it does under the force of gravity and basic principles, relatively basic principles of physics. So, not that it's totally simple, but they can calculate how long it would take a star the size of the sun to get to where it is now in terms of temperature and diameter and so on. And it comes out 5 billion years, plus or minus half a billion years, which is pretty close to the other ways of getting the age of the Earth. And the Earth itself, there are some ways, some clever ways of looking at the uranium lead amounts in the Earth, and they point to a common ratio, a common source from the same thing as the meteorites and so on, that wouldn't match other solar systems. And when they do that, then there's an indirect way of sort of measuring the age of the Earth directly, and it comes out 4.6 billion years by lumping all Earth rocks together in terms of their uranium lead average. But that one's not a direct measurement. The oldest fossils on Earth, and maybe they'll discover older ones sometime in the future, are about 3.5 billion years old, I think, at least from Canada, doesn't say. And these are primitive bacteria. Well, I say primitive. Prokaryotes, bacteria that don't have nuclei. Like the Gunflint Formation. Who's from Minnesota? So some of these old fossils, does the Gunflint go back? Maybe that's only 3.2 billion or something like that.
The rocks, the fossils that are in there, 2 billion years.
2 billion, okay, a little bit
younger. They have some of the oldest
ones. The older ones.
Some of the very
old. Yeah, I think it's, yeah, okay. But certain parts of continents do have older rocks, like Minnesota up into Canada for North America. Parts of Australia, parts of South Africa have some of these older rocks, and in some places, some of these old primitive fossils. Now, if accepting the way these age measurements using the radioactive isotopes, life started on Earth at least 3.5 billion years ago. Humans, Homo sapiens, as opposed to Homo erectus, say, the oldest Homo sapiens goes back to between 100 and 200,000 years. I think it's over 160,000, 180,000 years. There's some African Homo sapiens fossils, but nothing older so far. So compared to life 3.5 billion years old, Homo sapiens only going back maybe no more than 200,000 years. Humans haven't been around that long, okay? And dinosaurs, by the way, went extinct about 65 million years ago. So they weren't around at the same time, except in the comic books and so on. Any questions on that? Let's see, one other point.
Do there have been any fossil records of plant life? Record that, and does that evolve at all?
Oh yeah. Cheryl may know more about this than me. Angiosperms, flowering plants, they're a later arrival that has done well compared to relatives of ferns and horsetails and other plants that didn't have their gametes, their reproductive cells and methods of those other plant types besides the angiosperm. Well, it's judgmental, I suppose, to call them more primitive, but they were different than flowering plants, and in some ways, flowering plants are more successful and have outcompeted them in many niches, many environments. Because don't angiosperms only go back to the Cretaceous or the Mesozoic anyway? Yeah. So, in 250, 300 million years ago, there were these forests with these big trees and also big insects flying around and reptile lizards crawling around the ground, but there were these four dinosaurs. And none of those trees were flowering trees. There were no maples, no elms, no alders, no. They were all these other types of plants that don't reproduce with seeds the way flowering plants do. And I'm not a biologist or a botanist. But later, I think in the Mesozoic, it might have been only about 150 or 120 million years ago, the first fossils of flowering plants started appearing. And since then, they've only flourished more and more and kind of pushed the non-flowering type plants into a smaller part of the plant population on Earth. So yeah, and there's a lot more to it than that, but there is a fossil sequence that matches an evolutionary, or makes sense in terms of an evolutionary sequence for plants on Earth, for plant life on Earth. Okay, this one, let's go to point number 3, because we're going to run out of time. Textbook in 1 hour, it's got to move along. Earth systems, that's become, like I was saying, geology, geology, I like to carry my rock hammer and hammer in on rocks, but as the science evolved or developed in the last century, it got more and more interdisciplinary, it seems like. And because they realized that everything is so connected together, it's almost like, what's the name of the guy that wrote a Sand County Almanac?
Nick.
What is it?
Alda
Leopold. Where his basic principle of ecology is everything is connected. Well, it's not just living things are connected. Everything, rocks, air, water, life, it's also interconnected in ways that, it seems obvious. You can draw some obvious connections, but there are more there, and there's more interactions back and forth in these connections than we used to realize. So the common way of thinking of the Earth as a bunch of systems that interact is to break it down into the geosphere, which is the geological Earth, rocks, and the iron core, and so on. The hydrosphere, which you probably can guess is water on Earth. Atmosphere, the gaseous envelope around the Earth. And the biosphere, life on Earth, okay? Those are the four main Earth systems. You can also, if you want to partition it down, you can break out ice on Earth from the hydrosphere as the cryosphere, frozen Earth, or icy Earth, etc. And then geology refers to other sciences to keep itself in check and up to speed as a science. What's driving these Earth systems is, they're made of matter, including the biosystems, the biosphere, and they're driven by energy flowing through and in and out. These are not completely closed systems. So exchange of matter and exchange of energy go through these systems and among these systems. As one example, it's commonly accepted among Earth scientists now, and there's evidence for it in various ways, that the early Earth's atmosphere had no free oxygen to speak of. Okay, and then after about 3.5 billion years ago, life on Earth was happening, according to the fossil record. And by 2.5 billion years ago, there were there's still single-celled bacteria-type organisms, but a lot of them, they were doing photosynthesis. When you think of a plant, you think of something with roots and leaves or whatever. These were photosynthetic organisms, and a lot of them still exist. But they live on the floor of the ocean or in the ocean, and they did photosynthesis to the point that by 2.5 billion years ago, photosynthesis takes in carbon dioxide and it puts out oxygen. And so the Earth's atmosphere became oxygenated and remains oxygenated because of our friends, the plants. We need those guys. Look at science fiction stories. If you're going to go colonize another star and you jump in your spaceship to spend a few centuries, you better take some plants along. It's cheaper than packing in a million tanks of oxygen. Because you breathe out some excess carbon dioxide after taking in excess oxygen, and they go the other way around. It's kind of symbiotic isn't the right word, but it's a win-win situation. But the point there is that life on Earth has profoundly and completely, if that's correct, changed the composition of the atmosphere. That's totally accepted in geology, that life can affect the atmosphere to that extent.
Have they figured out how many trees it takes to support one human life?
Yeah, somebody has. at least depending on the assumptions they made. I've seen some websites that are like that. The Earth, in terms of matter, is not a completely closed system. We get meteorites coming in, and we get dust, tiny meteorites, or down to the scale of dust, you know, many billions of tons a year, although compared to the Earth's whole mass, it's still almost negligible. But it's not a completely closed system. And the Earth loses a little bit of gas, especially hydrogen and helium, at the top of its atmosphere, and a few other gases, in tiny amounts every year, not tiny, but in small amounts every year. But that the amount it's gaining and losing from meteorites and dust and gas escaping from the top of the atmosphere is pretty small. It doesn't change much over the course of billions of years, apparently. We do get energy from the sun. Oh, now remember, we're talking about heat coming out of the Earth's interior, and that drives geological processes like volcanoes and earthquakes and plates moving, which maybe I should say plates first, because then the plates moving drives most of those other processes. So that's coming out of the Earth's interior and getting released through geologic processes. But then we get the heat from the sun, which drives a lot of processes, including some geological processes like floods on rivers and weathering of rocks and so on. Yeah, huh?
Isn't the tide one of them?
The tide, okay, let's grab
it. Because the sun floods on the moon.
Yeah, the tide is gravitational energy from two objects interacting with, that's a good point, yes. And so then gravity itself, not only tides from the moon and the sun, but just gravity pulls things down slopes. I think it's going to come up on a later point. So I'm going to move on. Okay. By the way, I've never tried to whip through earth science literacy in 1 hour. We're not going to cover every point. I just want to, I'm seeing if people stay awake and if it's interesting. And what questions come up and what parts of it you want to know more about or didn't seem clear. So I guess you're part of my experiment then. Just looking at earth science literacy. Instead of taking a whole bunch of classes and learning these things step by step until you're an expert, we'll just take the overview from the top here and see what we get. Okay, the Earth is continually changing. I talked about it in one of my other sessions. If you want something that doesn't change, you can turn to the Earth. That rock over there or whatever, Gibraltar, hasn't eroded much in human history, hasn't changed much. The thing about Earth science and geology is human history is a small part of geological history. So if you allow more time to go by, then, and even, every year, so many pounds of the rock of Gibraltar are eroding down into the Mediterranean Sea. If you look closely enough, even those unchanging things are constantly changing. And if you allow enough time to go by, they're going to change completely. By the way, this is Lake Diablo in the North Cascades over the crest about 30 miles and 40 miles that way. Now the thing about, it's in this point, some people, this is the group that wrote the initial draft of what became this document that I was with. And some of them wanted a big idea point, a whole page, for the rock cycle, like I talked about the other day. Some of them wanted a whole page for plate tectonics. And there was a big push for that. But both plate tectonics and the rock cycle are embedded in here, in this big idea, which is that the Earth is continually changing. Something is driving the Earth to be continually changing. Energy flow, et cetera, is driving the Earth. So if you look down here, it starts talking about tectonic plates. Kind of assumes you know what they are. And it mentions that it's not just the crust, it's also the upper mantle, like we talked about yesterday. And it makes the point that I always make, that much of the Earth's geologic activity really happens a lot at the plate boundaries, where the plates meet up. And then here's the rock cycle down here. Magma turning into igneous rock, eroding off, turning into sediments, getting metamorphosed inside the Earth into a different type of rock. It's all right in here, in one little paragraph. So we can apply this just briefly before we leave this page. These last three points, these last two points, which is Holden sits on a bunch of sediments that have been shed from the mountains around here. Why? Because the mountains are uplifting, and anything that sticks up above zero level on Earth above sea level, is going to have forces, including gravity, but also heat from the sun and so on, and weather, that are trying to pull it back down. Why is it lifting up? Because of plate tectonics. Why plate tectonics? Because heat's coming out of the earth. I mean, it all connects together. But here we are in this tectonically and magmatically uplifted mountain range. It's undergoing erosion, and here in this valley, the erosional processes have been stream erosion. Streams erode and make valleys by erosion. By the way, back in the days of Leonardo da Vinci, it was assumed, it was assumed that the earth was created with the valleys already there and the streams started flowing. But now geologists think that the streams create the valleys by erosion over time. But around here, there are also glaciers, okay? So Railroad Creek was probably a system of streams before glaciation occurred. And then the glaciers took advantage of the pre-existing stream valley and reshaped it and scooped it out even more. And then the glaciers left, except for a few remnant glaciers higher up. So in the ground around here, there's a lot of sediments that the glaciers brought through from further up the valley. So there's stream erosion, and streams bring sand and gravel down, especially during floods, but also just as they flow along. Glacial erosion and redistribution of sediments, and there's some of that in the ground under here. And landslides and slope failures just from gravity. You got these steep sides of the valley, especially after the glacier left. They're not very stable because they're so steep after with no glacier against them holding them up. So you get a lot of rock avalanches, and even the soil on these steep slopes creeps a little bit every year as it freezes and thaws and so on. So, they went around and drilled a bunch of holes around Holden in the last couple of years as part of the new move towards mine waste remediation. It's mainly to study how the water's moving underground, but they had to see what's under there in terms of the geology, and they find glacial sediments, and they find stream sediments, and they find avalanche debris coming up that's come off the sides of the valley. It's all there in various combinations depending on where you drill. Not a very stable place in the long run, but we'll hope it holds up for now.
Has GPS and satellite positioning made it the science more specific as far as like these, it says 10 centimeters? I mean, is that...
Yes.
Due to our new technology, or
it is. Which one are you planning to here?
I don't remember.
Oh, right here. Yeah. Well, we already knew the 10 centimeters a year was already deduced by averaging out over hundreds of thousands or millions of years from the magnetic record on the ocean floor. What's really neat is that the GPS has added an independent check of what was already deduced or interpreted from the geologic record from the past. You can't just take your Garmin and see if North America is moving closer to Asia. You got to build in a real stable GPS station that doesn't move and is fixed to the rocks, and you got to do a bunch of them because different parts of the continent are going to undergo mountain uplift, and they're along a fault zone. They might shift this way because of the local fault zone. But when they average out motion of North America and motion of Asia from these careful GPS measurements, it's 99% exactly like plate tectonics had already estimated it was from the geological record. So it's a really great thing about how technology has allowed us to verify, but also learn more details about how some parts of the continents are a little bit slightly weaker and disconnected a little bit from the other part, and they're not exactly moving the same way, just approximately details like, they are learning a lot more details that we're still puzzling over. The continents are not quite, and the plates are not quite the rigid single slabs we thought they were, just approximately. We're learning more about those details from GPS. But I want to mention, and there was an earlier point, I think on the first page, about how technology helps drive the science forward, and that's true for any science. So GPS is adding new information to geology and plate tectonics and erosion and soil creep and things like that. Another example is that we can now, since the 20th century, after Madame Curie discovered radioactivity, we've been able to measure ages of rocks better and better. But before the 20th century, in the 19th century, they had no way of measuring the age of a rock. All they could do is figure out the sequence, what's older and what's younger. But nonetheless, before the year 1900, back in Victorian times in England and so on, they had figured out that back in the Cambrian period, there were just these arthropods and clams and things. And then up in the Pennsylvanian, these giant trees formed. And they had all those periods named and stacked out in order, including fossils that are in them, and they had the sequence, and they had it all named, and the names haven't changed much. We still say Pennsylvanian or Jurassic or whatever. Then came the 20th century, and they could measure the ages of the rocks, And it didn't upset the order at all. It just gave us ages. So it's not often mentioned, but it verified that geologists had it right all along in terms of the sequence. They weren't just making it up. That this fossil was older than that fossil, and so on. So the technology can often verify what we already knew in some cases, but add more detail and new knowledge as well. But we're running out of time later. Okay, we're going to speed up a little bit. Okay, because this one, we had a rebel group that wanted to emphasize that the Earth is a water planet. They wrote off, they went off into their own room and wrote it up, and here it is. And I haven't studied this one very carefully. But it's true. I mean, I can think of a few examples where water on Earth, I mean, other planets have water, but the Earth has water in all three forms, solid, liquid, and gas, in great abundance at its surface, more than any other planet, at least in our solar system. So the Earth has a range of temperatures and a composition with hydrogen and oxygen, among other things, that make that possible that the other planets pretty much don't have between the gas form of water and the solid and liquid form of water. And as far as we know, life, like we know it on Earth, cannot exist without water. Water, liquid water, ice, solid water, erode and do other geological processes. The hydrosphere is part of it. You know, there's school children at a couple grade levels learn about the water cycle, the hydrologic cycle. And water's inside the Earth as well. When Mount St. Helens erupted in 1980, what blew that volcano up was a bunch of water turning into water vapor. And that water, at least a lot of that water, apparently got into the volcano from the subducting plate that had water in it from being on the bottom of the ocean for a while before it caused melting. The water went into the magma, the molten rock comes up, ready to come out of the volcano. The water that's dissolved in the hot magma wants to come out, and in some cases, like Mount St. Helens in 1980, it explodes its way out. So there you have water from the ocean that went down the subduction zone, that came up the volcano, that blew up, and water gets everywhere, including inside the Earth. Okay, three more to go. Maybe we'll make it. Okay, life on Earth. This is, I might lose my geology license if I say the Gaia hypothesis. No, I wouldn't lose it. But the connections between life on Earth and the geology of the Earth, they are intricate, and they're not independent of each other. It's not like the rocks are just this passive platform where life happens. Life evolves on Earth, and I mean, if evolution